I'm very pleased to welcome back to View from the Roundhouse Professor Martin Drum from Notre Dame University. Good morning, Martin.
It's great to be here, Michael.
I suppose we should be relishing the opportunity we have to talk about politics globally, around the world, around the country, locally. I mean, the world's in a complete mess, Martin. It gives us plenty to talk about, I suppose. I mean, who'd go into politics? I mean, who'd want to be dragged through the ICAC? Who'd want to be caught up in the Victorian IBAC doing a similar sort of job? Who'd want to be standing for political office, Martin? And what about the issues? You know, gambling and immigration gets people going. And I imagine it might just get you talking this morning. But can you tell our listeners straight off what's happening in the almighty polls? Everything is controlled by the polls, Martin, or isn't it?
Oh, the polls, everyone talks about the polls. I'll give you a little bit of an ups, a little bit of a snapshot over what's going on, probably just focus on the last month or so. So the story of the second quarter of this year, so starting from May through maybe April through to June, was the rise in One Nation, the collapse in the coalition vote, and a decline in Labor, but not as marked as One Nation. As market as the coalition, and the Greens steady somewhere between 10 and 15%, which is actually not too bad for them in the national vote. So you've got Labor's polling around about across three or four polls around about between 25 and 30%, usually closer to 30. One Nation, mid 20s, but some polls have them as high as 30. And coalition, often south of 20. There's one recent poll that had them well over 20, which is a bit more encouraging for them, but well back in the field there. And the Greens, like I said. So what's that all do? Well, in preferential voting and single member electorates like we have in Australia, it's very difficult to predict how that actually translates into seats. But usually most analysts will advise that Labor would likely still form government with a much narrower majority because of preferences, and with One Nation being the predominant opposition party and the coalition pushed back in priority and visibility and the like. So that's a particularly bleak picture for the coalition. It's a bit of a, it should be worrying and concerning for Labor as well because they're on a much narrower majority, and if it continued, who knows? And obviously much more encouraging for One Nation supporters.
Well, as you say, it brings into focus the preferential voting system we have in Australia. It's not first past the post. You know, if there are a number of people, you look at how the people down the bottom of the poll would have spread their votes if they'd not been able to vote for that party. What does this do when you start talking about the position that One Nation appears to be in? Does this mean that they're likely to push the coalition out of some of the seats around the country?
If this trend continues, and bear in mind we don't have another election until 2028, so there's a lot of water to go under the bridge. Probably don't have another election, you never know. If that continues, One Nation would at least become the predominant opposition party, and the number of Liberal National seats would slump. It may well be below 30, but they'll certainly lose a lot of their influence, a lot of their support, a lot of their key MPs would be defeated. So I think that that's probably where the most angst is at the moment. But I did mention that Labor has a very massive majority, and that would be whittled down on the under current polling to a much, much smaller majority. So there'll be plenty of MPs that will be worried in their seats too.
Well, it looks like One Nation are getting ready to be what you call a much more professional outfit. They've got themselves a new guy who's come across, used to work for Scott Morrison.
A lot of people, there's quite a few people who sort of worked in one of the coalition parties, Liberal National, that are disaffected for one reason or another. Don't believe the coalition is conservative enough or populist enough for their liking, and they're gravitating to One Nation. You could call some of them opportunists, Michael. They see an opportunity there that they didn't have before. I still think there's going to be an issue with One Nation finding really good quality candidates across the board. And we see this with a lot of parties seeking to make an impact where they haven't been before. in attracting and retaining really good candidates and not losing them once they're in office.
Well, Chris Taylor's the guy in question. He's left his job sort of to us here at the Australian Banking Association, some suggesting he wanted the top job, but he didn't get it. Now he's moved across to join Pauline Hanson's party. As I say, he used to work for Scott Morrison. He knows politics. He's a lawyer in the background. What do you expect to see when you have someone like that come into the political party? I suppose it's just going to require a lot more discipline on a lot of people's part.
I think that there will be a lot more professionalism. And as One Nation aspires to win seats they would never have won before and attract voters they would never have won before, they know they need to change their act somewhat. They can't just be a maverick all the time. They've got to release some coherent policies. They do talk about immigration, but a lot of the other policy settings are much more fluid. So expect that to come out, a bit of a suite of policies and some professionalism in the party machine that didn't exist before.
You mentioned immigration. This seems to, I mean, never ceases to be a bit of a live wire issue around the country, around the world. We've been through it in the Howard era here. It seems like Labor Party here is pretty much lockstep with everybody else on the topic. I mean, is there much between the parties on immigration? Where does the government in Canberra stand at the moment?
So immigration reached its peak in the post-COVID environment of the coalition government, and it's been slowly whittling down then. And there was a good reason why it did at the time, because there was no immigration at all during COVID. So they were trying to compensate for that in the immediate post-COVID period, and then that's whittled down somewhat. So it's around about 185,000 is the target this year. And 70% of that is the skilled migrant program. And that's addressing skilled worker shortages in construction, mining, aged care, health, all these parts of the services industries. So there's very good reasons for it from the business point of view, but obviously it's in the headlines at the moment because of housing shortages and other services shortages where people are blaming it. So the government's stuck between the wishes of business and some of the sentiments in the broader public. And that's why Tony Burke was going to address the press club this week and put it off, because even inside the party, there's some fairly stark differences about how to go about this.
How would you think those differences would be or should be described?
I think there's a general sense that they need to be seem to be doing something about it, but at the same time, they're trying to balance the needs of business. So that's that tension that exists there. There are some different components in that immigration program. So it's what do you move on? In the skilled part of it, there's the different occupations on the list. So then that leads to the debate over what's on the list and what's not on the list. And different members of cabinet might have different views on that. Then there's the family reunion part, where you offer an incentive for workers to come out because they might be able to bring close family members out. So you do cut down on that part, but then you're going to lose skilled migrants, Michael. And then there's refugees as well. So look, there's different components of it. How hard do you go on different components of it? And that really is where I think a lot of tension and stress is.
As I say, who wants to be a politician and get caught up in all of this? But yes, migration, one can understand it's an important issue and it gets people talking and often reflected in the polls that we've been discussing. Is gambling an issue that there's a lot of talk, but is it an issue? What's happening in Canberra at the moment? Is it a bit of a logjam?
It's seriously a political issue at the moment. It's causing consternation and now public consternation within the government. So you might recall there was a major report by now deceased Labor MP Peter Murphy that called for really strident measures to crack down on gambling advertising. And the government, after waiting quite a while, has announced changes, but those changes don't appear to have satisfied anyone outside Labor. And increasingly, I think there's consternation in Labor about the changes as well. So outside Labor, both the Greens and Liberals, in their own way, have suggested that some things didn't go far enough. And now some Labor MPs are talking about going further as well. And we had an inquiry about the legislation, Michael, up at the Federal Parliament. and you had people saying, look, these gambling companies offered me drugs, they offered me sex workers, they did all these sorts of things to get me gambling. And that's pretty damning information, and that's part of this push for tighter regulation.
If you're not going to sit on the fence, Martin, do you reckon that we're going to see the late Peter Murphy's proposals more or less implemented in the end?
I suspect there's pressure on them to do more, and they will. Once you start getting your own MP saying, I think we can do more, I think the pressure is on, and there is some support across the board, especially on this inducements issue, Michael, to go a bit further. So they can choose to cut a deal with either the Greens or the Coalition. Probably the Coalition's ask is more modest in their eyes, but I think that they probably will make some changes.
Well, all of that stuff is, in a sense, the good side of politics, debating important policy in relation to immigration numbers, dealing with social issues like gambling. But there's the other side of politics where the ordinary punter, you and me, Martin, oh, not so much you, but me perhaps, and we think, gosh, it's a messy business, isn't it? And then we get the ICAC, the ICAC inquiry, continuing in Sydney. And it looks like all these young Catholic boys from expensive private schools have left school and got together and are trying to stack the branches by getting their people in. Martin, looks a bit messy. Have you been following it?
Yes, and I think it is. There is quite a lot of fascinating information coming out there. There's branch stacking going on, which itself is not new, but who's paying for it and what do they want? Also, whose money, Michael, is being expended here in this branch stacking? And to what extent is it clearly contravening legislation on political donations? So there's some fairly meaty, weighty issues that are there, and both yes, Catholic schoolboys caught up in these things, but also several MPs now caught up in these matters within the New South Wales Liberal Party. So that's another ICAC investigation that's catching a lot of eyes at the moment.
I suppose it just reminds all of us, we the occasional punters who get called along at elections to vote, that within the parties there are all of these factions. You've talked about it before. The Labor Party has them, and they don't always like each other, one faction v the other, Martin.
Well, there's a saying in politics that your real enemies are behind you, not in front of you. In front of you. And you think about the way the chamber is set up in our state and national parliaments. Think about that for a moment. When the daggers come out, they hit you in the back, not in the front.
Well, Victorians, as I mentioned, have got the IBAC, the Independent Body Against Corruption in Victoria. It's not quite as powerful as the ICAC in terms of the matters they can pursue and some of the powers they've got, but there have been some serious suggestions recently that there will be reforms to that. But they brought down an awaited report. It didn't find anything in one sense too much, but it did tell us more about the construction industry, Martin, and there's going to be a Royal Commission into it.
But this is the where corruption reports are interesting because they don't necessarily, didn't necessarily say that there was clear corruption, but they the way the content of the report pointed to a whole range of behaviour on the part of senior government officials that was concerning, might be a better way to describe it, and it's put those people all the way up to ex-premier Daniel Andrews on the back foot accordingly. So when these things are aired and when we see reports about them, it's not just whether you contravened the law or is guilty of serious misconduct. It's also generally about how you conduct yourself. And I think, Michael, that's why a lot of nervous people about this Royal Commission into Victorian construction projects coming up. That's the next thing IBAC will be looking at.
Well, we'll come to see exactly what's happening there. The Royal Commission will be appointed. We'll find out. It'll probably take quite some time to follow through. And we've got the election in Victoria in a couple of months, so we'll be talking more about that. But leaving the shores of Australia for the moment, we keep hearing about Iran and Oman talking about the Straits of Hormuz. Have they got anywhere yet? What do we know?
Well, we've had so many false starts in this respect, and there's smoke, but is there any actual fire here? A little bit of context, you had Iran actually bomb several or attempt to strike several US bases. And normally that would enrage the US and upset them and cause a strike back. But the nations in the Arab world around that, your Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, have told Trump to hold fire because of the implications of this. And so he's talking up peace again. But again, is there any substance to this? It just reminds us of the bind that Trump's in, because he hasn't been able to keep the Straits of Hormuz open. He hasn't been able to find a resolution to the conflict. And even when Iran strikes him, he's a bit hamstrung about what to do. And there's even this latest report, Michael, about whether the US could be running out of missiles. That would be extraordinary, I would have thought, if that were to actually happen. Don't know the truth of that, but it's extraordinary it's been reported.
Well, you have to be careful what you say, because they're also hunting down all of the people who are leaking in the US. They're going to no doubt charge them with treason or doing something which is contrary to the Secrets Act, and they'll all be thrown into jail probably, Martin. So we better be very careful what we say, ho-hum. But we watch and we wait. They keep talking about the Iran-Oman agreement. Well, let's see what happens. In the meantime, the Russians and the Ukraine don't seem to be any closer, Martin, to their fight and resolving it. I mean, there's now a lot of activity along the Black Sea, the Ukraine shipping or shipping coming into the Ukraine to pick up goods, wheat are being bombed by the Russians. At the same time, we see a couple of oil installations in Russia being bombed by the Ukraine. I mean, none of it seems designed to resolve the conflict, unless you take the view that hitting each other really hard is the way you resolve a conflict.
That this is another conflict that's just dragging on and on and on, and this time in particular, Russia must be very frustrated. But if you want to see the unpleasantness of modern day warfare, there's a clip doing the rounds on the internet. I presume it's authentic, Michael, of a drone hunting down a fruiterer. A guy who owns a fruit shop is being hunted by a drone. So he's running away, and the drone's following him to explode on him. And that's the horrors of modern warfare, that you could be just going about your normal thing, and all of a sudden there's a drone hovering over you, terrifying you. In the case of the broader conflict, we're still in a stalemate situation, but what we can say is that Ukraine definitely has certain offensive tactics that were not available to them earlier, including its own use of drone warfare and attacking on shipping in the Black Sea. So this is a really ramped up in recent months, where both countries' shipping is being drastically reduced on that account.
Well, I suppose one day it'll be of interest to people involved in strategic studies, peace and war, and historians. But there's no end in sight. I mean, would you make any predictions when we first started talking about this years ago? We wondered how quickly it would wrap up.
I think most people, when it first happened, were worried about whether Ukraine could withstand the onslaught at all. But once they did survive those first couple of months, I think it's always been a stalemate. Sometimes one army has the edge over the other and makes some gains. But have we seen a really drastic change since then? Probably not. And it's difficult to see anything beyond a stalemate for the immediate future.
Well, let's just remind ourselves about politics again. All these young men and women who dream about going into politics. The Labor Party in Western Australia have a new minister, the Minister for Mines, Petroleum and Exploration, and Water. And he's done what a lot of these politicians have done. He went off to university, got a BA in politics and history, very familiar route to politics. Martin, you've probably seen a few come through. I'm talking about the Honourable Daniel Pastorelli, MLA. He's the state member, obviously, for the ALP in Lansdale, one of the northern suburbs. He's got quite a background, but I suppose what happens is you come in and somebody thinks, well, you have to have a shot at you. And Basil Zempelis, the leader of the Liberal Party, you can't call them cheap shots. They probably have got a touch of humour in it, but you have to expect to be attacked and see what you're made of, Martin. Have you noticed they went for him the other day?
Certainly, and I think now Minister Pastorelli's only been in the job a matter of days, so I do really feel for him. And he's literally, I think he's taken the job Monday, I believe, and already in his first week, he's got 200 Wordle Corp workers that are threatening to strike on him. So talk about picking up the poison chalice, Michael. So really feel for him here, and I think it's actually this is a culmination of months of negotiations, missed negotiations, pay retention issues in the organisation that are coming to a head. So talk about sort of being landing in the hot water, and so this will be a test about his abilities. He's often been seen as a rising star in the WA Labor Party, so he'll have to find a solution to that.
Well, he's probably seen it all in one form or another. He's a young guy. He worked for the super popular Mark McGowan when he was premier. He's been close to the cabinet, being the parliamentary secretary to the premier, and now he's got this gig. And in WA, resources portfolios are pretty important.
Oh, very much so. Well, he's not going to a minor portfolio when he's just coming into cabinet. He's going straight into one of the most critical areas of the WA economy when in terms of mining. So he's got mining, but he's got water. He's got a few other smaller portfolios, and he's certainly got his work cut out at the moment.
Well, as I say, politics, Martin. I suppose we just can't do without it. Any big predictions, or is it just going to be business as usual in the state and the Commonwealth for the next period through to Christmas?
Well, for our WA listeners, we've just got a couple of weeks to go, and we might revisit this just on the eve of the poll of the Secret Harbour by-election. And that's shaping up as a very tight contest, Michael, so we might revisit that in coming weeks.
We will. We need to see what the placards that are being put up down in Secret Harbour are. We might have to send one of the Fremantle Shipping News staff members down there to take photographs, Martin, and see if we can judge from the quantity and quality of the placards that are going up, who's going to win. Would you make any predictions at the moment?
No, I think it's incredibly tight. I think One Nation is right in the hunt here, and it could go either way. Ask me on the eve of the poll. I'll make a prediction then.
Martin, as always, been lovely talking to you. Thanks for joining me today.
A pleasure as always.